Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's Friday again. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, and welcome to Free for All Friday on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And a few weeks ago, we did an episode on historical misconceptions. You know, Napoleon wasn't actually short, for example. He was average height. His height's been misinterpreted, you know, ever since British cartoonists took aim at him in the early 19th century. Things like that. Because I love history. I studied history as an undergrad at Arizona State University. Go Sun Devils. Well, not really. I wasn't that big into my alma mater. I went to Arizona State because it was 10 minutes from my house. It was an easy transfer from Scottsdale Community College. Go Artichokes! That's right. We were the Fighting Artichokes. They called us the Artichokes. The student government, by the way, did that because they were mad about the school not giving them more funding. So they voted that the mascot would be a vegetable and that the team would always have to say the word choke when they were chanting. So a little bit of history there. And that lets you know I'm a big history buff. I really enjoy history and I love uncovering the facts about history. That's why in my journey to become Catholic, history played such a deep role. If you know that Cardinal Henry Newman once said to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And I actually discussed that at the conference, the Catholic Answers Conference, and of course, revealed that in my talk on Protestant distortions of the Church Fathers, which you can check out here on the podcast feed as well. So I love history. But the more you study history, the more you see that many things we think we know about history are not actually so. So today, I have seven more historical misconceptions you've probably heard and passed along that I would like to remove, what's the word I'm looking for here? To disabuse you. I think I should just do another podcast just on building one's vocabulary. I'd like to disabuse you of that notion. Vocabulary is also very important. I'd like to thank my junior year English teacher for introducing me to a book, 1100 Words You Need to Know. It's a great vocabulary builder. I don't know if it's still out there, but I remember that she introduced me to 1100 Words You Need to Know and helped expand my vocabulary. And I would give public speeches in her class, and she required me every time I said, anytime I said one of those things, you'd have to write out 50 times, I will not say, like, you know, or any other kind of verbal hiccup in handwriting. You had to write that out by hand. I will not say, like, you know, these kinds of verbal hiccups. And you did it over and over again until your hand hurt. Now, that was old school. But guess what? When you listen to me here on the podcast or when I'm speaking, it's very rare for me to say, like, you know. I mean, it happens. I'm still human. But those are verbal fillers. And when people use them excessively in conversation, I absolutely hate them. Because here's a tip. If you don't know what to say in the moment when you're trying to come up with the words, don't say anything at all. Just look pensively out at your audience or stare at the microphone and your computer screen. And you can just think to yourself what you want to say. There is nothing wrong with a pause. A pause is infinitely better than verbal hiccups like, and that's a correct use of like. You can use the word like if you mean such as. But like, it's like, you know, like not a good way to use the word like in that context or, you know, so verbal hiccups. So I thank my junior English teacher for helping me to shed that habit, as well as introducing me to vocabulary in 1100 Words You Need to Know, because I want to disabuse you of these historical misconceptions. Also, it would behoove you to know history correctly. I know the word behoove because I remember when I was a kid, I watched a cartoon once to build vocabulary, and it was about a woman learning what things behoove you. It would behoove you to not place a beehive in your new hairdo. So, you know, now you learn two more words, disabuse and behoove. So now let us continue on to our historical misconceptions today. Misconception number one, the Vikings wore horned helmets. When you think of a Viking, what do you think of? I'm not talking about the sports team. I'm talking about, you know, the Vikings from the Norseland, Scandinavia, going in their long boats with dragon heads in the front. I'm sure that's probably not accurate. You know, raiding and pillaging villages. And we always think of them wearing, you know, fur coats and these clubs and shields and spears and helmets. And their helmets have these giant horns on them, right? Well, it turns out in depictions dating from the Viking Age between the 8th and 11th centuries, warriors appear either bareheaded or clad in simple helmets, likely made of either iron or leather. And that makes sense. Think about it. If you're in hand-to-hand combat with somebody, and you got a helmet you've strapped on with like a leather strap, and it's got giant horns on it. What purpose does that serve, really? I mean, it might make you look cool, but you're not going to... The reason animals have horns is because they bash each other in the head with their heads. They ram each other. They impale one another with the horns. Humans do not have a neck capacity to do that. So what purpose would it serve? The only purpose it would serve would be in a fight, the other person could grab your helmet easily and yank you down to the ground or break your neck in the process. So it's not practical. And despite years of searching, archaeologists have yet to uncover a Viking-era helmet embellished with horns. In fact, only one complete helmet that can definitively be called Viking has turned up, discovered in 1943 on the Gjermundbuch Varm in Norway. The 10th century artifact has a rounded iron cap, a guard around the eyes and nose, and no horns to speak of. That's from an article at history.com. All right, so why do we think that the Vikings had horned helmets when they didn't? What gave us that idea? Well, it was probably the opera The Ring of Nibelung, or Der Ring des Nibelungen, first produced in 1876. It's a cycle of four German-language epic musical dramas composed by Richard Wagner. Wagner, of course, you'll remember, is the composer behind some of Trent's favorite pieces, including Ride of the Valkyries. No, Classical Trent, no! You cannot be in this episode. Some people enjoyed you on the classical music episode of Free For All Friday, but a fair number of people found you highly annoying. So I don't think you'll be back on the podcast for quite some time. Well, that's unfortunate. They can always catch me at K-Jazz between the hours of 1 a.m. and 1:30 a.m. right here in San Diego. Okay, that's enough. That's enough. That's enough. But you'll remember, not too long ago, I did my classical music pieces that I enjoy, and Ride of the Valkyries is one of them. Dun, 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 dun. And that is in The Ring of Nibelung. And in there, one of the cycles and one of it, that you see the Vikings, and there they have horns on them. That was, of course, produced in the 19th century, not super historically reliable to give us what Vikings were really like. But of course, to think of Vikings, we think of another historical misconception was that the first European to make it to the New World was Christopher Columbus. That's not true. Leif Erikson and possibly other Vikings before him explored Vinland, which was either the island of Newfoundland, part of modern Canada, or a term for Newfoundland and parts of the North American mainland. Runes at Léons aux Meadows prove that at least one Norse settlement was built in Newfoundland, confirming a narrative in the saga of Eric the Red. So the Vikings made it to the New World before Columbus did. They just explored up in Canada. In fact, they were like the first ones to get to mainland Canada. Columbus didn't even make it to the mainland, to North or South America. He landed in the Caribbean. Historical misconception number two, the vomitorium, the idea that Romans, there was a room at palaces dedicated to vomiting up food during meals so you would have more room for it, and that room was called the vomitorium. That is not correct. The vomitorium was an archway in stadiums and in the Colosseum that would allow people to exit quickly from the building. So literally the building, the stadium, the Colosseum would vomit out its occupants by they would all leave and rush out through these archways. And modern stadiums still have these things to this day. And those were called the vomitoriums. Nobody vomited in them. The arena would vomit the audience out through these ways, metaphorically speaking. Saturnalia of Macrobius in the 5th century described the archways in this way. So why do we think that about the vomit? There was a vomitorium where the ancient Romans would vomit up their food while they ate. Well, it was a practice among aristocrats and the emperor class, among the ruling elite in Rome, to vomit up food so you could eat more and engage in gluttony. That is recorded. Two sources on this. One is Suetonius, who wrote a wonderful treatment called The Lives of the Caesars. We learn a lot about them from Suetonius. For example, Suetonius wrote the lives of, I think 10 of the Caesars. In any case, I don't know if it was 10, but he records the lives of several Caesars. It might have been 12. And one of them is Claudius. You might know him from the miniseries I, Claudius, which is a wonderful series. Emperor Claudius actually expelled the Jews from Rome, and Suetonius is one of two historians who record this event. The other one is not Josephus, it's not Tacitus, it's St. Luke in Acts 18. Luke records this action of Emperor Claudius who expelled the Jews from Rome, and Suetonius records this, but nobody else does. So Suetonius is a great source for history of the Roman Empire. He talks about Emperor Claudius, who reigned in the first half of the first millennium after Christ, AD. And he said of Claudius, once when he was holding court in the forum of Augustus and had caught savor of a meal which was preparing in the temple of Mars, he left the tribunal, went up where the priests were, and took his place at their table. He hardly ever left the dining room until he was stuffed and soaked. Then he went to sleep at once, lying on his back with his mouth open, and a feather was put down his throat to relieve his stomach. So Suetonius says that Emperor Claudius would vomit up food because he ate too much of it in his meals. Seneca the Younger also records this. He says, talks about the elite bringing together food from all regions everywhere, and which their stomach, worn out with delicacies, can scarcely retain, is brought from the most distant ocean. They vomit that they may eat, and eat that they may vomit, and do not even deign to digest the banquets which they ransack the globe to obtain. So he has a very critical view of the aristocracy in this way, that they ransack the world for food. They don't even bother to digest it. They just want to taste it, swallow it, and they vomit it up again. So the Romans did do that, but there was no room called the vomitorium dedicated to that practice. Historical misconception number three, the pyramids were built by slaves, and in particular, the Jews. I always kind of make this joke. People will say, Trent, why aren't you going to help us build this? And I say, look, we already built the pyramids. We Jews are done with building. We're done with that stuff. Except, and I say that in jest because the Jews actually did not build the pyramids. No slaves built the pyramids. Egyptian records show that it was hired workers and laborers who were contracted to build the Great Pyramids of Giza. And it certainly was not the Hebrews, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who built the pyramids. That's not possible because the Great Pyramids of Giza were built around the 26th century BC, before Christ. That's about 500 years before Abraham was called from Ur to the Chaldees to a new land, and over 1,000 years before the Hebrews were enslaved under the Egyptian pharaoh. And there's dispute among scholars about which one that is. A very popular one is Ramses II, though I believe Thutmose is another one who is about 200 or 300 years earlier, is another common, less common candidate, but Ramses II is one of the most common candidates. So it was long before that time. So the Hebrews did not build the pyramids. However, as I note in my book, Hard Sayings, Egyptologists have discovered the presence of Semitic names in Egyptian records from the time of the Exodus. They have also found descriptions of forced laborers making bricks in order to meet quotas, as well as failures to meet those quotas because of a lack of straw, details that can all be found in the Book of Exodus. The famed Egyptologist Sir Alan Gardner, who was generally dismissive of the historicity of the Old Testament, said that Israel was in Egypt under one form or another, no historian could possibly doubt. So we do have evidence of Semites, of Hebrews who dwelt in Egypt. We don't have extensive evidence because they lived in the Goshen, the land of Goshen, which is on the Nile Delta, that routinely floods every year. It's not great for preserving archaeological finds. You get a lot better stuff preserved in Upper Egypt and in areas of Egypt that are dry and away from the Nile. We've found a lot of great artifacts, manuscripts. The oldest copy, partial manuscript of the Bible, I think it's the Charles Ryland manuscript. Was it P135? It is a copy of John 18, verses 32-33, dated to around 125 AD, which is great because there were scholars who used to say the Gospel of John was written in the year 150 or at the end of the second century. And so that little papyrus put to the flames dozens and dozens of skeptical scholarly works that tried to date John really late because the book could not have been written in 150 if there is a manuscript in Egypt dated to 125 AD, which you also have to give time for the manuscripts to get out there. So there's evidence, and we could go through this. Check out my book, Hard Sayings, for more about evidence for Israel in Egypt. Also a great source for that is the Egyptologist James Hoffmeyer. Hoffmeyer did a great book on Israel, on the Exodus and the wandering tradition in Sinai that many archaeologists like to poo-poo, but actually there's decent evidence to support the biblical accounts of those events. And by the way, while we're here talking about Egypt and the Exodus, I had to play for you a clip of my favorite movie. Probably this is easily one of my favorite biblical movies. I mean, if you're Catholic, you kind of have to say The Passion is your favorite movie. And I do love The Passion. It's a great film. Well, I mean, it's like if you put anything above The Passion, it's like blasphemy. But honestly, I really love The Prince of Egypt. I think it is a beautifully animated film with excellent voice acting, music, and it portrays just such a human element in the relationship between Moses and Ramses II, that they were, who were once raised together as brothers, are now enemies as Egypt is torn apart over Pharaoh's stubbornness. I mean, it's a beautiful film. Great voice acting work. You got Patrick Stewart as the Pharaoh, the father of Ramses and the adoptive father of Moses. Jeff Goldblum as Aaron. Moses, that's probably not a good idea. Must go faster, Moses. It's wonderful. Val Kilmer plays Moses. They get a different guy to do the singing voice, a tenor. Ralph Fiennes, excellent actor, who plays Ramses II. I got to play a clip. It's about a 90-second clip from Prince of Egypt. This is the song All I Ever Wanted and Let My People Go. It's a song that's played during the plagues. So as you hear it, imagine the locusts, the frogs, the disease, fire raining down, all the plagues. And then you hear Moses and Pharaoh arguing about it in song. Just 90 seconds. I got to play it for you.
This was my home. All this pain and devastation, how it tortures me inside. All the innocent who suffer from your stubbornness and pride. Why must you call down another blow? May grow, this will still be so. I will never let your people go.
Let my people go, thus saith the Lord. I love that. And you know that basically everyone involved in this is not Christian, and they still make better Christian movies than we do. I can't handle it. See, this is art. This is art. Christians, it's okay to make things with Christian themes. We should be doing that. But it has to be art first. If you want to make a sermon, that's fine. Giving sermons are great. But if you want to make art, art has to come first. It has to be art first, and the theme will naturally flow from that, and it will move people. But you have to reach people's tender, affective emotions through the skillful use of art, which is a whole other podcast we have to do at some point. You're all bringing an expert to talk about it. That would be certainly fun. So if you haven't seen it, 1998 film produced by DreamWorks, Prince of Egypt, classic. I definitely recommend it. Number four, historical misconception. The Iron Maiden was never used as a torture device. So maybe you've gone to like museums. There's a Museum of Man here in Balboa Park in San Diego, and they actually had a history of torture devices. They had a little exhibit a few years ago on different kinds of torture devices. I don't recall if the Iron Maiden was in there, but when you think of torture devices, you think of the Iron Maiden, which is like a metal shell that looks like a woman, but with spikes inside of it. You put the person in, you close the Iron Maiden, and it impales them, or at least they can't move inside of it without getting impaled. According to Wikipedia, despite its reputation as a medieval instrument of torture, there is no evidence of the existence of Iron Maidens before the early 19th century. The device, known in German as the Eiserne Jungfrau, looked very similar to an Egyptian mummy sarcophagus. Wolfgang Schild has argued that putative Iron Maidens were pieced together from artifacts found in museums to create spectacular objects intended for commercial exposition. And oh, it says here there was one on display at the San Diego Museum of Man. So we don't have evidence for that, but we do have early evidence of something similar to the Iron Maiden that was used as a torture device prior to the birth of Christ. This is recorded by the Roman historian Polybius, and it's called the Iron Agepa. And he's talking about Nabis, who was a ruler at that time, And this is what Polybius the historian says. He says that Nabis, he had also constructed a machine, if one can call such a thing a machine. It was, in fact, an image of a woman richly dressed and was a very good likeness of the wife of Nabis. Whenever he summoned any of the citizens before him with the design of extracting money, he would begin by addressing him in kind terms, pointing out the danger to which the city and country were exposed from the Achaeans, which is a region in southern Greece. And then we need mercenaries, and so we need you guys to pay more of your taxes. If they yield to these arguments, it was sufficient for his purpose. But if anyone refused and objected to pay the sum imposed, he would continue somewhat as follows. Very possibly, I shall not be able to persuade you, but I think this, it's not a Geppa, or is it? A Geppa or a Pega? I think it's a Pega. A Pega, not a Geppa. A Pega of mine may do so. This being his wife's name. So it's the Iron Apega. And even as he spoke, in came the image I have described. When a man offered her his hand, he made the woman rise from her chair, taking her in his arms, drew her gradually to his bosoms. Both her arms and hands, as well as her breasts, were covered with iron nails concealed under her dress, so that when Nabis rested his hands on her back, and then by means of certain springs, drew his victim towards her, and increasing the pressure, brought him at all in contact with her breasts. He made the man thus embrace, say anything, and everything. Indeed, by this means, he killed a considerable number of those who denied him money. Basically, so the Iron Apega was a woman, an iron statue with rusty nails in it, with springs, and you'd have to go and give it a hug. And he would flip a switch and the arms would come around you and squeeze you and you'd kind of be impaled on these iron nails and the arms would keep you from escaping. So that's the Iron Apega, which may even be scarier than the Iron Maiden. I'm not sure. But we had that from Polybius before about 200 BC. Historical misconception number five. George Washington chopped down a cherry tree. You've heard this one all the time. George Washington cut down a cherry tree. His dad asked him, did you cut it down? He said, I cannot tell a lie, because our first founding father was basically perfect. You know, that we had this hero worship of George Washington. He could do nothing wrong, and this story came from that. According to one account, the cherry tree myth is the most well-known and longest-enduring legend about George Washington. Ironically, this iconic story about the value of honesty was invented by one of Washington's first biographers. I think this comes from MountVernon.com. After Washington's death in 1799, people were anxious to learn about him. And the man, Mason Locke Weems, was ready to supply the demand. As he explained to a publisher in January 1800, Washington, you know, is gone. Millions are gaping to read something about him. My plan, I give his history sufficiently minute. I then go on to show that his unparalleled rise and elevation were due to his great virtues. Weems' biography, The Life of Washington, was first published in 1800 and was an instant bestseller. However, the cherry tree myth did not appear until the book's fifth edition in 1806. Number six, Marie Antoinette never said, let them eat cake. So the idea here was that the French Revolution, 1789, occurred, that Marie Antoinette and other members of the aristocracy and the ruling class were executed because they didn't care about the poor, and Marie Antoinette selfishly ignored them when they said the people have no bread. Well, here, I'll play a clip from the movie Marie Antoinette with Kirsten Dunst. I think it's from 2006, and they dramatize it.
Let them eat cake.
That's such nonsense. I would never say that.
The movie got it right, that she never said let them eat cake. And that, you know, it's not like the movie didn't even peddle it. They have Kirsten Dunst's Antoinette say, I would never say something like that. And here's the thing. There is no evidence she said that. The French phrase is, cuise manger de la brioche, brioche. I'm sure I'm mangling my French, just like I mangle every other accent. Cuise manger de la brioche. Brioche is, you can go to the store. It's not cake. We just said brioche. It's just kind of a fancy sort of bread. And it comes from Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So Rousseau was a French humanist philosopher who said, at length, I remembered the last resort of a great princess who, when told that the peasants had no bread, replied, then let them eat brioches. Now, when Rousseau said this, Marie Antoinette would have only been about 14 years old. She hadn't achieved the status of a great princess yet. She wasn't even living in the same area where Rousseau was. So there's no evidence that Rousseau was talking about her. So how did it get attributed to her? One article says, many anti-monarchists, so those who are opposed to the royal crown, were so convinced, albeit incorrectly, that it was Marie Antoinette who had single-handedly ruined France's finances that they nicknamed her Madame Déficit. In addition, or Madame Deficit. In addition, anti-royalists, libelistes printed stories and articles that attacked the royal family and their courtiers with exaggerations, fictitious events, and outright lies. It's quite possible that a discontented individual fabricated the scenario and put the words into the mouth of Marie Antoinette. And now it is time for our last one. The last misconception is Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, was born in the year zero. There is no year zero. Jesus was not born in the year zero, but you might think, wait, there's BC and AD before Christ, Anno Domini, year of the Lord. Isn't he born in zero? No, the Anno Domini era, AD, was introduced in 525 by the Scythian monk Dionysius Exiguus, or Dennis the Short, if you will, who used it to identify the years on his Easter table. He introduced the new era to avoid using the Diocletian era, based on the accession of Roman Emperor Diocletian, as he did not wish to continue the memory of a persecutor of Christians. Because here's the thing, prior to this time, you didn't have dating conventions with years. You would date things, usually in ancient Rome, you would date things based on the founding of Rome, or during the year, the 15th year of this emperor, the 70th year of this consulship. You dated it based on the rulers, not upon anything independent. So how Dionysius arrived at the number, the calculation is unknown, but he did not use AD years to date any historical event. That began with Bede, who I believe is the Venerable Bede, who lived in the late 7th and early 8th century, who used AD years in his Historia Ecclesiastica Gentis Anglorum. As I note in my book, Hard Sayings, before Dionysius' dating system, Christians referenced time using events like an emperor's reign or even the Olympic Games. Even today, the Liturgy of the Midnight Mass at Christmas recounts how Christ was born. The timing we use in the Christmas Mass say when Christ was born was during the 194th Olympiad, so the 194th Olympic Games, the 752nd year from the foundation of the city of Rome, the 42nd year of the reign of Octavian Augustus. And using those references, several church fathers and ecclesial writers, including Irenaeus, Clement of Alexandria, Tertullian, Origen, and Eusebius, said that Christ was born somewhere between 2 to 3 BC. Now, a lot of scholars will try to put him around 5 to 6 BC. Based on the death of Herod the Great, which is hard because we talk about, Luke says there was an enrollment to the whole world. This was not a census, but it was a loyalty pledge, an oath to the emperor. And Augustus did call for one of these loyalty oaths in the time around 2 to 3 BC when Christ was born. So that's not a historical anachronism or inaccuracy in the text. And in fact, Andrew Steinman has done great work to show that Herod the Great was died closer to the year 1 BC than the year 4 BC. So when was Christ born? At least the year, the date and month is a whole other topic we'll have to discuss in a separate episode. But at least for the year, the best traditional evidence and modern evidence, I believe, converges somewhere between the years 2 to 3 BC. As a final fun note, I always hate when I go to classes or I read in books, they use the terms BCE. And CE instead of BC and AD, because apparently before Christ and Anno Domini are insensitive and imperialistic and just so terrible. So I'll be on universities and they'll date things BCE, before Common Era, and CE, Common Era, instead of before Christ and Anno Domini or AD, which is just silly. Even Richard Carrier, who of course I disagree with him on many things, actually agrees with Christians on this one, that BC and AD, that BCE, before Common Era, and CE, Common Era, are really silly conventions among academics. This is what he writes in an online editorial, online essay. I think it's called BCAD, BCECE. He says, "The newfangled convention has been promoted in an idiotic and patronizing attempt not to offend non-Christians who have to use the Christian calendar. Yes, it's a Christian calendar, full stop. That's the same non-Christians who we're to suppose are still being regularly offended by having to call a day Saturday, even though they don't worship the god Saturn. Christians don't get offended by naming a calendar day by a non-existent pagan god, so why should non-Christians get offended by naming a calendar year after a non-existent Christian god? Remember, Richard Carrier is an atheist. He doesn't even think Jesus existed, but he still thinks that BCE and CE are silly. He goes on to say, Calling the sixth day of the week Saturday, literally Saturn's day, does not entail embracing a Eurocentric worldview or belief in the god Saturn. It's just using the English language. So too the labels BC and AD. The new convention is even stupider than that, of course, because it's embarrassingly Orwellian. He says both terms, BCE and CE, indicate the same exact division made by the same exact religion for the same exact reason to honor the same exact god. Either way, it's the same demarcation. And it's silly. So I love with academics, they say BCE. I always want to ask them, wait, well, when does the Common Era start? What started the Common Era? Well, it's the birth of Christ, but we don't call it that. Well, you still got to give the Messiah his credit where it's due. So, hey, I hope this is helpful for you. I enjoyed sharing these historical misconceptions with you. If there's other historical facts and tidbits you would like to learn about here on the podcast Free for All Friday, do let me know. Happy to investigate them. Leave a comment at trenhornpodcast.com. You all have been great, and I hope that you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.